Yesterday we looked at the end of the Middle Ages and considered the seeds of the Renaissance we found there. I told you that although I disagree with the philosophy of Thomas Aquinas, have significant disagreements with him, that we must nevertheless respect the accomplishment of Aquinas in history in presenting an all-embracing worldview in terms of which not only was there a place for what men would consider their natural functions, thinking about the world and life, but also a place for their religious devotion, a worldview that made the university possible, a worldview that brought cultural integration to the High Middle Ages. Again, it's not a worldview that I believe was ultimately honoring to God and not ultimately beneficial for Western culture, but it did have that feature. After Aquinas, we begin to see a disintegration of that integrated and all-embracing worldview. Signs of disagreement and departure or challenge, especially in three Franciscans, Roger Bacon, Duns Scotus, and William of Ockham. And I just want to make sure you can check your notes against my summary today, see if you picked up on what we were talking about yesterday. In the case of Roger Bacon, we see the seeds of the Renaissance in his textual studies. Secondly, in his understanding, which was new for his age, of the utility of direct experience of nature, the utility of science, and the empirical emphasis that that he encouraged over against the Aristotelian speculation about nature and what it must be like. Bacon taught us that there is only one divine truth, so that the work of pagan philosophers is not opposed to divine wisdom. And I tried to point to the ambiguity in that remark. It is the case that the work of pagan philosophers, to the extent they find the truth, must be harmonious with what we are pursuing as God's people, because there is only one truth. And yet one should be on his guard about pagan philosophy just because of the motive that's behind it, which is, of course, to escape the living and true God and not to submit to his revelation. The second Franciscan that is chipping away at the Thomistic synthesis was Duns Scotus, perhaps the greatest opponent of Thomas in the Middle Ages. According to Duns Scotus, knowledge need not be mediated by the senses. This was a premise of the theory of knowledge set forth by Thomas Aquinas, based on Aristotle. And Duns Scotus said, man in his unfallen condition would not have needed to gain knowledge solely through his senses, although now after the fall he does. Duns Scotus held to the controversial view that God and man both have being in a univocal rather than equivocal sense, but he introduced his notion of a formal distinction. Essence and existence are inseparable in God and in man, but there's a formal distinction, because you can imagine essence and existence, you can imagine them separated in man. According to Duns Scotus, divine illumination is not needed for natural knowledge. It is not needed to avoid skepticism. Duns Scotus held that the individuation, the principle of individuation, is not matter, as Aristotle and Thomas had taught, but rather he felt there was a form of individuation, the thisness of things, so that every individual particular has its form, as well as the class in which it's a member. So there is a form for Dr. Bonson. I know that's frightening. Bonsonness, it's called. And there's also a form for humanity, of which I am a member. And as I told you yesterday, this doesn't really help philosophically, because you end up having as many things in your explanation as you have in what you're supposed to be explaining. But nevertheless, Duns Scotus was opposing Thomas, and I want you to see that. He also opposed Thomas by maintaining the primacy of the will over the intellect. And for this reason, God has the sovereignty, the sovereign freedom to send the Virgin Mary to hell if he chooses to do so. The only commandments of God which could not be altered by his whim are the Ten Commandments, and the only reason they cannot be altered is because they are, for Duns Scotus, although I find this highly unpersuasive, they are an expression of the law of non-contradiction. And then finally, in Duns Scotus, we see a reduction of natural theology. Scotus felt that Thomas should not have been as certain of his conclusions as he was, nor did he think that the conclusions you could draw in natural theology are as broad as Thomas thought. Okay, so Roger Bacon, Duns Scotus, and then the third Franciscan that we looked at yesterday, William of Ockham. For Ockham, faith and reason are radically separated. They are in different spheres altogether. It is not the case, and this is a classic Thomistic way of putting it, it is not the case that faith perfects reason. It isn't as though reason has its proper domain and can discover certain things on its own, including the existence of God, the general character of God as all-knowing and all-good and so forth. And then what you do is faith is added to the results of reason, thus perfecting, if you will, bringing to completion what reason would have been able to do. Ockham said this is not the case. Faith and reason are in watertight compartments. They are in different spheres altogether and may even lead to contradictory results. What you come to when you think through things on the basis of faith may be the contradiction of what you would come to when you think through things on the basis of man's natural reason. Ockham did have the piety, if you want to call it that, to encourage people to follow faith even when it was irrational, when it came to conclusions which were contrary to reason. But nevertheless, what's important for our purposes is that, like Averroes, we mentioned at the very end of class yesterday, this idea of double truth, where theology and philosophy have different truths and they can't ever have a contradiction that needs resolution because they don't touch each other. Likewise, William of Ockham separated faith and reason completely. And I taught you that the result of this, not only back in the Middle Ages, but also in the 20th century, when you have that view of the relationship of faith and reason, necessarily, you will secularize reason. Reason operates on its own. Faith doesn't control it. Faith is not the foundation for it. Faith has nothing to do with it. And so that's why you'll see so many fundamentalist churches, which are so pietistic in terms of their Sunday devotion and so forth, and their understanding of Christianity. They'll even, you know, be down on doctrinal sermons and so forth. They really want to appeal to the emotions and to the will of men. You'll have so many fundamentalist churches that are very, very strong in terms of this view of faith, and yet turn right around and have a secular view of reason, have no difficulty with people going out and studying science or engaging in political activity that has no relationship to Christianity at all. And when conflicts come up, they just live in two different worlds, you know? In the day-to-day world at the science lab, I just assume man is an animal. He's just a bag of tools, and I do my work like everybody else does. The difference is that on Sunday I go and have this irrational faith experience, and my emotions are appealed. Well, this would have been very much like William of Ockham. Ockham said they don't have any relationship, and therefore he secularized philosophy, reason, and science. Ockham taught us that the divine voluntarism, the fact that God's sovereignty is a matter of the whim of his will, divine voluntarism would lead to skepticism about natural knowledge. We'd never know if the things we are studying are not God's constant intervention in miracles. Of course, the good news, if you call it good, is that that's only true theologically. And this really has no bearing on reason and science and the way we pursue them. when we get into the realm of philosophy, reason, or science, Occam said there is no problem about universals. Throughout the Middle Ages, philosophers had debated back and forth whether universals are real, are they mere words, are they concepts in the mind, and so forth. Occam said, everybody's making a big mistake here. Universals are just a convenient tool of language. Universals are terms that help us summarize the members of a class. So the universal man is just a shorthand for Plato, Aristotle, Socrates, and then list everybody else in the phone book. What about the natural sign of man? So that when we see individuals and we get the term man in our mind, according to Occam, that is just a psychological event. And in my criticism of Occam yesterday, I told you he had not solved the problem of universals, he just transferred it. Now we have to ask, how can these individual brain events, these psychological events, whereby naturally we say man when we see these individuals who are men, how can one event like that be considered identical with another event like that? So that when we identify man over and over again, it's the same natural sign in our mind. So though he was brilliant in some ways, William Occam took the easy way out here. And that fits in with my last remark about him, and that is that according to his dictates, when we're doing philosophy, when we're doing science, we should always prefer the simpler explanation. Now, that doesn't mean that he was committed to simplicity. There may be some things where no matter how simple the explanation is relative to other explanation, it's still highly complex. But his point is, always take that hypothesis that does not project unnecessary entities. And we all hold to what's called Occam's razor, shave off unnecessary entities in your explanation, whether we've studied Occam or not. You know, if you go to two auto dealerships that want to fix your carburetor. And you say, well, what's wrong with this carburetor? And one dealership gives you, you know, this mechanical explanation, you know, it's got this electrical problem, or, you know, it's not, it has a jet that's jammed or something like that. And then you go to another one, and that dealership says everything and this, and Martians are coming down from space and causing the jet to be jammed and the computer not to work properly. You probably figure the addition of the Martian intervention is not all that important for getting the carburetor fixed. And so using Occam's razor, you would shave off the Martian intervention part and only pay attention to the simpler explanation. Okay, so we see the seeds of the Renaissance in the utility of direct experience in Bacon, in the reduction of natural theology in Duns Scotus, and then finally the secularization of natural theology, the secularization of nature, pardon me, and of reason in William of Ockham, and a preference for a more scientific approach to things, what we today would call a more scientific approach. Okay, bottom line, the end of the Middle Ages, what you see, I think, characteristically, is a dichotomy between two different realms. What started out in Thomas Aquinas is the idea that faith perfects reason. Reason operates on its own, is self-sufficient, doesn't need divine grace in order to find out certain natural things. And certain natural things include natural theology, truths about God naturally learned. Reason operates all right on its own, and then faith perfects it. We start out in the High Middle Ages with this view, and by the end of the Middle Ages, what we have is a complete dichotomy, not the idea that reason finally provides the foundation for faith and faith perfects it, but you have two different realms that are not related to each other. You have the realm of faith or theology,
the realm of divine grace. And remember, all that can be irrational. And Occam would say, even though it's irrational and conflicts with what you learn in your natural experience and the use of your natural reason, believe it and follow it anyway. That's perfectly okay. Hold on to that domain. If faith, theology, and grace. But then, what I'm trying to indicate here is that you've got a 6-foot-wide concrete wall. Now, actually, it's 100 feet wide, and it's steel. You have completely watertight compartments. Faith does its thing up here, and that's perfectly all right. That's devotion. But then down in the lower story, if you will, we have reason, science, and nature. Now, I just want to make sure, does everyone understand what I'm getting at when I say this? These two domains have been dichotomized. You have the realm of grace or faith, and then you have this 100-foot-wide steel wall separating it from nature, science, and reason. Don't take my figures reach literally. My point here is that where Aquinas provided autonomy for reason as a fundament for faith, and therefore they are different and yet related to each other closely. Faith perfects reason. By the end of the Middle Ages, the Franciscans who were departing from and or challenging Aquinas had taken his realm of reason and made it completely autonomous. Now it operates on its own, and you don't even have to relate faith to it. These are watertight compartments. And so the end of the Middle Ages is characterized by this dichotomy. Now, if you'll pick up your reading of Schaeffer at that point, I think it will be much more intelligible to you. When Schaeffer, throughout his explanation of Western culture, talks about the dichotomy, he almost always calls it the nature-grace dichotomy. And that's okay, as long as you understand where it comes from. It's the dichotomy between faith and reason, between theology and science. And I'm going to give you a thumbnail sketch now if you want to catch Schaeffer in one gulp. What he's going to argue is that this dichotomy, which is a grace-nature dichotomy in medieval theology and philosophy, will become secularized. The dichotomy will stay there, and it will become a dichotomy between value up here, which can be irrational, and reason, or fact, in the lower story. So you have the facts that we encounter in nature. And how do we learn about the facts in nature? Through reason and science. And then you have these values. I'm not room on my board, but I hope you can see this. We have these values in a different domain which have no relationship to the facts. And this will set us up for what Schaeffer considers the crisis in the 20th century. Dun Scotus didn't believe you needed divine illumination in order to gain natural knowledge. And so down here in the realm of reason, as you're studying nature, you don't have to have divine illumination. So reason becomes, if you will, self-sufficient. Now, he did believe, though, and this is interesting, that the fall had affected reason. But in what way? The fall had affected reason so that now everything we learn comes via our senses. But if we weren't fallen creatures, we could know truths, we could know universals, we could know essences, and we could know God directly, not just via what we see here and so forth. We would have a direct, intuitive, and inward knowledge of these things. So it's kind of strange. Dun Scotus believed that the fall had affected man's ability, and he thought Aquinas didn't take account of that sufficiently, but then he had a completely bogus understanding of how the fall affected man's reasoning, I think.
He should have realized that the fall made man's reasoning rebellious and therefore trying to get away from God with whatever tools you have, be they rational or empirical. Another question?
Yeah, the point I brought up yesterday about Pelagianism of the church, how it might be called prevention of why they separated faith and reason and eventually broke down. I guess the expression would be as the church goes, the world goes.
Yes.
And the point I was trying to bring up was that Augustine came into the picture and he gave a more consistent view of the sovereignty of God, which really eliminated the autonomy of man. His understanding that he can brought faith and reason together. And the Pelagianism crept into the church, which allowed man not to think God's thoughts after him, to think autonomously. So what he did was that he separated faith and reason gradually. The church gradually accepted that. So God required it to slow down. And so the church had the grip of minds of people, and they had civilization in one sense of Christianity, but then it was broken away because of Pelagianism.
Yeah, I guess what I'm thinking, though, that's just an oblique and very roundabout way to say what I've just said here. Essentially, Pelagianism would lead to making reason self-sufficient, because man in himself is self-sufficient before God, not only in the works of his body, but also the way he speaks and thinks and so forth. But I mean, if that helps you to organize the material and to see it that way, it's just that the Pelagian controversy doesn't seem to have played a part. And anybody in the Middle Ages would have said Pelagius was wrong. I mean, any churchman, and that Augustine was right. They would have honored the patristic reputation of Augustine and repudiated Pelagius, all the while having the seeds of autonomy within them because of their works righteousness schemes. Okay, another question? Okay, then we'll move on to the Renaissance. All right, as we continue, we come to the period of the Renaissance in your outline. We're now at Roman numeral 18. The word Renaissance means rebirth. Okay, so this is the born-again age, right? The Renaissance, however, has nothing to do with the rebirth of faith or the rebirth of the human heart regenerated by God. The Renaissance is understood as the rebirth of man in all of his glory. It's the rebirth, ultimately, of humanism. The difficulty in understanding the Renaissance, or better, the Renaissance spirit, the reason I say Renaissance spirit rather than age, is that it overlaps so much with the end of the Middle Ages and with the beginnings of the Reformation that in order to untangle these things, you really have to look for the spirit of the Renaissance over a 250-year period rather than a specific age that you consider the Renaissance and then another age, which is the age of reason or whatever it may be. But the difficulty and understanding that the Renaissance is the revival of humanism is that so many of the Renaissance scholars were professing Christians, and so much of Renaissance culture was intertwined with the life of the church or some kind of religious devotion or an appeal to Christian morality or what have you, a criticism and call for the Reformation, the change of the church in a number of ways. But nevertheless, there is a distinct conceptual and moral difference between the Renaissance and the Reformation. And in your outline, what I have indicated is that the Renaissance is the renaissance of a man-centeredness, a humanistic spirit. Specifically, as A in your outline indicates, the Renaissance is the revival of the classical period and the man-centeredness of the ancient Greeks. Many people during the time of the Renaissance, many people with the spirit of the Renaissance, would have glorified the ancient world not because of the gospel, not because that's when Jesus and the apostles were on earth, but would have glorified the ancient world because the glory of Greece is seen there. And so there's a desire to go back to the classics, meaning the age of Plato and Aristotle and all the rest. In your textbook, by Sahakian, on pages 119 and 120, he tells us that the period of Renaissance philosophy saw the rebirth of Greco-Roman culture. And then he immediately explains that that's the revival of an independent spirit of learning. The renewal of interest in the humanities, and with the downfall of scholasticism, the termination of the subserviency of philosophy to theology and to the authority of the church. Basically, the Renaissance was a freeing of man from the yoke of ecclesiastical dogmatism. Now, is this right or is this wrong? Well, in one sense, it's correct. In the Renaissance and in the Reformation as well, we see a freeing of man from ecclesiastical dogmatism. What's ecclesiastical mean? Relating to the institutional church. The institutional church in the High Middle Ages had kind of a stranglehold and an oppressive tyranny over every aspect of life, over the thinking of men, over the economic situation of men, their callings and vocations, even over the political order. And it is true that with the coming of the Renaissance and Reformation, there is a lessening of the church's authority in society at large, and a lessening of an intellectual bondage to whatever the decrees of the Pope and his minions might be. But you see, that's not really what's at the heart of the Renaissance. The Renaissance is not a freeing of man from ecclesiastical dogmatism, though that came with it. I mean, you get that in the Reformation as well, which is clearly a different spirit than that of the Renaissance. The Renaissance is a freeing of man from any obligation to theology or divine revelation. It's a revival of the classical autonomy of the Greek philosopher. The man-centeredness, the idea that man is self-sufficient. He can learn about the world on his own. He has a dignity all in himself. He can accomplish great things with his natural abilities. He can solve his problems without divine intervention. He can even get things worked out intellectually without recourse to divine revelation. So as Sahakian says, the rebirth of the Greco-Roman culture, specifically a revival of an independent spirit of learning. Independent of the church and its dogmatism, the Pope, yes, but more importantly, independent of the Word of God. Independent of the authority of God speaking in the scriptures of the Old and New Testaments. And then in that same long paragraph beginning this chapter, Sahakian comments that the seeds of the Renaissance had been sown in the philosophy of John Duns Scotus, with its emphasis upon the separation of philosophy from theology, of reason from faith, and so forth. Now, that you understand after yesterday's lecture and my introduction this morning. The only difference is that where he says it's Duns Scotus, I would argue more broadly and importantly it's William of Ockham, but you get it in Roger Bacon, you get it in Duns Scotus, and specifically in Ockham. But he's right. That's the seed of the Renaissance spirit. Separate philosophy from theology. Separate nature from grace. Separate faith from reason. That's the end of the Middle Ages. If man's reason has been separated from faith commitments and from divine revelation in its authority, then of course go back to that period of time where philosophy was done without the Bible. Right? And you can't do that by looking at the Middle Ages. The Middle Ages was thoroughly infected with religious considerations. They may have been, you know, incorrect theologically and morally, but nevertheless there was religion there that people had to toe the line to. But prior to that, if you get back to the classical age, then you see man in his autonomous glory. Okay, so maybe I'm overplaying this, but I want you to see what the key distinguishing spirit of the Renaissance is. The revival of classical culture, because it represents a man-centeredness, the sufficiency of man, the autonomy of his reason, and the glory of what he can accomplish intellectually, artistically, culturally, politically, what man can accomplish without recourse to the supernatural. The revival of classical man-centeredness. Let's look at some of the cultural characteristics of this renaissance of humanism. It's very difficult to separate the period of the Renaissance from its the previous period or a successive period, because the Renaissance is a period of transition. I have not added the dates to this long list of names that you see up here on the board, but I thought by putting all these names up here, it might help you to see the way in which the end of the Middle Ages blends in with the beginning of the Renaissance, and you can't easily separate it. As we go through the lecture this morning on the Renaissance, I'll be referring, if I can, to all these people, but you'll notice that in some cases, I'll be referring to people, these are two columns, and they are in basic historical order. I'll be referring to people way back here, even though the person that's considered the last medieval philosopher is Nicholas of Cusa, and I'm going to underline him just so you see it visually on the board. Here's Nicholas of Cusa on the timeline, one of the key players in the beginning of the Renaissance is Dante, one of the political theorists of the Renaissance, very important, Marsiglio. Okay? Now, if Nicholas is the end of the Middle Ages, and yet in order to understand the Renaissance, we have to go back way up here. Here's Bacon and Duns Scotus. Here's Occam. Petrarch is considered the Renaissance man, the father of humanism. He's here. So I hope, if nothing else, you can just see the jumbling here. It's like a crisscrossing in terms of time. The Renaissance doesn't have a beginning point. I'm arbitrarily, for the sake of teaching here at Christ College, I'm arbitrarily calling the Renaissance period 1450 and on, looking at the date of Leonardo and the fall of Constantinople as good a significant starting point for it. But that's artificial. That's reading backwards and trying to set it up. I want you to see, as you do your timeline, that the overlap of the end of the Middle Ages and the beginning of the Renaissance, indistinguishable. And now, what if somebody says, yeah, but there's a period of the Renaissance and a period of the Reformation? That won't work either. Because some of the greatest contributors to the Renaissance spirit and science and the arts and so forth, look at Michelangelo, Castiglione, and so forth, they're right here with Thomas More and John Calvin in the days of Columbus and Henry VIII. You just can't separate these out. So you really have a medieval spirit that is dying out. The High Middle Ages with Aquinas is being chipped away at and finally tapering off into the secularization of reason in Occam. You have the beginning of the Renaissance spirit, which doesn't want to look at supernatural intervention, but you also have the beginning of a desire to go back to the purity of the Christian faith in the Reformation. All right, what are some of the cultural characteristics of what we call the Renaissance? I hope I've convinced you that I'm not dealing with an isolated period of time, but a spirit, if you will, a thread of thought, a certain religious motivation that runs through this 250-year period. Well, culturally, the Renaissance was certainly helped by exploration and discovery. In the 1400s, as you know, European nations, particularly Portugal, Spain, England, were sending voyagers out to explore the world. In 1415, the Portuguese gained a foothold in Africa, in Ceuta, and then throughout the 1400s began to explore Africa, to go further and further south down the coastline of Africa. The motivation for these voyages, I'm saying this is a contribution to the Renaissance spirit. And yet when you look at what was said about why the voyagers went out, Columbus in particular, it's obvious that many of these people considered their work in discovering the world to be in advance of the Great Commission. That isn't to say I agree with the theology of Columbus and others, but the fact of the matter is they saw this as part of the spread of the kingdom of God. Let me read to you from one of the letters of Columbus, where he's talking about his first voyage. He wrote that the natives were willing to exchange valuable things for trifles, but I forbade giving them a very trifling thing because it was plainly unjust. And I gave them many beautiful and pleasing things which I had brought with me for no return whatsoever, in order to win their affection and that they might become Christians and inclined to love our king and queen. What I believe our most serene king especially desires is their conversion to the holy faith of Christ, for which indeed, so far as I could understand, they were very ready and prone. Therefore, let king and queen and princes in their most fortunate realms and all other Christian provinces return thanks to our Lord and Savior Jesus Christ that so many souls of so many people heretofore lost are to be saved. And let us be glad not only for the exaltation of our faith, but also for the increase in temporal prosperity in which not only Spain, but all Christendom is about to share. Okay. Now, I just read to you from a couple of paragraphs of Columbus, his own words. What does he say at the end of this paragraph? He says there will be temporal prosperity to be shared in Europe for this as well. I find it incredible. I mean, it's not a sensitivity just as a Christian, but I think just as a fair-minded, hopefully fair-minded scholar, I find it incredible that people can read the words of Columbus and come back and tell us that all the talk about the salvation of the souls of the heathen was but pious overlay and whitewash of the greedy financial motive that sent the explorers out. I mean, I just read to you, I mean, he does admit that this is going to, the people who sent out the explorers are going to get gold and, you know, other sorts of things back, which is a wonderful, if you will, icing on the cake. But he says the main reason we are here is we want to see these people come to the faith. And they're ready to do so, and so forth and so on. Even if you're not a Christian, I just think fairness would require you to acknowledge that not all the explorers, certainly not Columbus, were motivated this by self-interest. But see, this is interesting. Most people look at the age of exploration as a contribution to the Renaissance spirit, and yet so many of the explorers were operating from explicit Christian motives. This in itself illustrates how, not confused, but how difficult it is to ferret these things out when you're doing historical analysis. Just to fill up, just a reminder, I hope, of what you've already learned before you got here. I told you that it was 1415 when Africa finally was breached by the Europeans. In 1492... Of course, ocean. Columbus sailed the ocean blue. You know that is the voyage of Columbus. In 1498, India was reached via the Cape of Good Hope. In 1499, South America was discovered. In 1532, an overland expedition via the Panama led the Spaniards to Peru. Okay, just so in terms of your timeline, you have some idea of what's going on here. Here's Columbus, 1492. Luther nails the 95 Theses in 1517. Okay, so that's 25 years, only a quarter of a century. Which 25 years today may seem like a long time, and then that was nothing. Virtually simultaneous events in terms of historical development. So I just want you to see where these things fall in. The spirit of the Renaissance is advanced by exploration because of the economic effects and the social effects that came about through it. My main point here is to give you a sense of where we are in history. 1498, India is reached via the Cape of Good Hope. Already, of course, 1492, Columbus has gone the western direction to reach India. You all know that he did reach India that way. Didn't he? Well, of course he did. That's why we call Native Americans Indians. You realize that? It still was not understood when Columbus returned that he had not reached the western side of India. Or it would be the eastern side of India. He had sailed west to get to India, and it was assumed that he had. And so the people in this continent come to be known as Indians. It's what I call, when I teach logic, the Columbian fallacy. You have a presupposition in your mind, and then all the facts are read in light of your presupposition rather than questioning whether it ever really got to India. Oh, you wanted the dates. I got off here. I'm sorry. 1499, South America, the coast of South America is discovered. By 1532, the Spaniards had marched across the Isthmus of Panama and reached Peru. That's 1532. Just, we're going to come to this eventually in the lecture. In 1513, Machiavelli completed his document, The Prince. 4 years before Luther nails the 95 Theses. Luther nails the Theses in 1517. In 1518, Thomas More publishes Utopia. 1536, Calvin publishes the Institutes for the first time. 2 years prior to that, Henry VIII had declared the independence of the English Church from Rome. Now, this is a fascinating period of time. I although my calling and specialty is supposed to be philosophy and so forth, if you're going to study history, you can hardly choose a more interesting period for all these, you know, momentous, significant things happening so close to one another. Cross-fertilizing and so forth. Well, back to exploration as advancing the spirit of the Renaissance because of the economic and social effects. With the discovery of America, South America, with the ability now to get to India without going overland through Europe and down through the Mediterranean and so forth, what happened is that trade routes were established, gold and valuable things were brought back, and you had a great increase in wealth. There's a shifting of commercial power from the Mediterranean area of the world to the Atlantic. I mean, the shift is in that direction because ships leaving the Atlantic go to the New World and go down around to India. And so what's happening is that traditional power centers are losing their power and new ones are developing. Why would that contribute to the spirit of the Renaissance? Well, what did I say? As you're looking at all this massive detail, what is that thread that runs through them that we call the Renaissance spirit? man's self-sufficiency, right? Man can make himself great. Well, exploration opens up the opportunity for men to assert themselves. And though I think that the early explorers were motivated by Christian interest in advancing the kingdom of God, it is true that the money that, well, it wasn't money, of course, like coins they brought back, but the bullion and the other wealth that was made possible through exploration enabled a spirit of independence. And social and political effects are seen in the same way. By contact with other cultures, people were less likely to just accept the traditions with which they had been brought up. They now have to learn to think for themselves. Well, is European culture superior? Moreover, the opening up of the world allowed for a spirit of freedom. When the Puritans were persecuted in England, now with the exploration of the New World, their options were much greater, weren't they? Just think about this. In terms of the independence that is allowed when you can flee from England and go to the New World and start all over again. I'm not being critical of this, and I'm not saying that the people who fled England were Renaissance men, but that's an illustration of how exploration opens up possibilities for freedom, for upward social mobility, for the challenge of tradition. Moreover, as people came to the New World, what kinds of values would have been exalted in the New World? In the New World, the values that would have been important would not have been what class into which you were born and special privileges you have, but when you're hacking out a wilderness, you'd better be able to hold your own, right? So the spirit of independence, individualism, self-sufficiency was very important in the New World. Well, that's what I'm getting at when I say that exploration contributed to the Renaissance spirit, especially the economic and social effects of the explorers and the opening of a new world. Yes, your question? Although I wouldn't say that shift away from Rome is to be understood geographically. It was a shift away from Rome because as people went geographically other places, it was harder for the papacy to maintain its authority and its oversight and stranglehold. Now, we see this also in the rise of money power during the Renaissance period. There is a radical increase in the use of money where the Middle Ages saw something of a guild system and a barter system. The Renaissance is a period where more and more money is being used as a means of exchange. This is a change in the method of financing, then, of commercial transactions. And when I say commercial, that doesn't necessarily mean transactions that are done by very wealthy traders and businessmen and so forth, going to the local market to buy a basket full of eggs is facilitated by having money, as well as becoming a trader who buys, you know, silks from India and so forth. So there's a real change in the way in which people are relating to each other in society because of the use of money. The feudal organization of Europe is being replaced with social contacts and methods of interaction that are more favorable to trade and to commerce. With the use of money, people have greater freedom in how they relate to other people. Stop and think about this. If the only way you're going to get milk or steaks is by making sure that you're in a good relationship with the guy who owns the cow, then that's going to have a lot to do with how much freedom in your social, you know, interaction you have with this man. If he's looking to you to provide hay, you know, for his animals and so forth, then you guys are caught, you know, pretty strongly in an economic loop with each other. But you introduce money where you can go to the market and maybe there are three or four guys that are selling milk or steaks, and he also can find other vendors of hay, then you see you have a great deal more freedom. And that spirit of freedom contributes to the idea that, you know, man can do things on his own. He's not bound by tradition or by old ways of seeing things. There was a change in attitude toward money lending. During the Middle Ages, money lending was looked down upon because it was thought that those who traffic in money were not doing anything profitable. They were just taking advantage of people. Moreover, the people who were the money lenders in Europe were, for the most part, Jews. And in the Middle Ages, the Jews were hated for a lot of reasons, but one that seemed to be religious is that they killed the Savior. But now, as trade is expanding, and you find out the value of being able to borrow money, that is to say, on time, have the ability to gain the supplies you need so that you can make products, sell them, and then pay the man back, you can get wealthy in a way that you couldn't have without the money lending. There's a relaxing of the church's a condemnation of usury, for instance, and we get fine distinctions now between usury and interest. Interest is the legitimate money that you can collect on a loan. Usury is what is exorbitant or oppressive. It's really kind of sad to see this kind of rationalization, but the point is there's a change in attitude about money. There's more money available. Just think of the inflationary effect of all the gold coming from South America and so forth. There's more money in circulation. And people are getting used to commercial transactions facilitated by money. Money lending is no longer quite as dirty a trade as it appeared to be. And profit making becomes now understood as something good, and in fact many in our Protestant heritage say is even a sign of God's pleasure in your life. Manufacturing once was in the hands of guilds. And you have to understand that the guild system, if you will, unionism to the max, the guild system prevented free exchange, and therefore people couldn't get ahead. If you lived in a city and you were in the guild that, is silver making, and you've got three or four guys older than you who are already making enough silver products to take care of the people, you're not going to get ahead in that guild, are you? But in a free market economy where you can go to a fair and put your wares out on the table and compete with other people, now it's not a question of where you stand socially and in terms of your age, but it's a matter of what you can do with your hands and how well you can sell. Okay. These are things that we have come to assume because they're just part of our lives. But you have to understand, this had a great impact on Western Europe. Exploration, the influx of wealth and money, a new attitude toward money, an opening up of markets. Particularly in Antwerp, there was a free market attitude where no tariffs were charged on foreigners who came in. And does it surprise you that that became the wealthiest city in Europe then? Why don't we learn from history? Pardon me if I have to, you know, take a little detour here and say something about our modern world. Why is it we continue to think that we can protect our industries with tariffs and with trade sanctions and that sort of thing, and that this is really for the good of the United States? We turn the United States into one big guild system, don't we? Where history shows always when you decrease your tariffs and allow for free trade, it's to the benefit, guess what, of everybody. Not to one side, because in a free transaction, both sides get what they want. Anyway, we see that at the period of the Renaissance, with the opening up of free trade, the use of money, the decline of the guild system. The Renaissance is also known for its revival of learning. There are three cultural characteristics. This is the third one that we've looked at. The spirit of exploration, the rise of money power, and now the revival of learning. When we speak about the revival of learning as part of the spirit of the Renaissance, let's make very sure we don't make a mistake that is propagated in a number of schools and colleges when they talk about the Middle Ages and the Renaissance. The idea is the Middle Ages was an age for dummies. The Middle Ages was the Dark Ages, when people were really, you know, bogged down in superstition and they weren't very talented intellectually and so forth. The Middle Ages flourished with people that had very keen intellects. Anybody who thinks, I don't agree with him, but anybody who thinks Duns Scotus was a dunce, is himself a dunce. You look at Thomas Aquinas and these others, these were brilliant men. The difference between the learning of the Middle Ages and the Renaissance is not that one was stupid and backward and superstitious and the other now believes in using your brain. The difference is that the men of the Middle Ages were learned in things that the Renaissance didn't care about. The Renaissance was a revival of the learning of the ancients, going back to the classics. This passion for learning about the ancient world, the classical world of Greece and Rome, brought with it a new ideal for education because it brought a new view of man with it. The Renaissance interest in classical culture came to be known as an interest in the humanities. And those who were interested in the humanities were humanists. And this will, you know, be very disturbing, especially to elementary or early on students in studying history. This term humanism and humanist, well, they're used in so many different ways. You have to understand sometimes, so that when we see the term Christian humanism, we think, well, that's got to be a contradiction in terms. A Christian can't be a humanist. But if by humanism you mean an interest in the humanities, a study of ancient culture, you could be a Christian and do that. But then again, it's not quite as easy as they make it sound, because though the humanists were interested in classical culture, they also picked up from classical culture what we call philosophical humanism, the setting of man at the center in terms of value and authority in doing our philosophy. Well, the father of humanism is Petrarch, 1304 to 1374. And so we're right about here on our timeline. Bacon, Duns Scotus, Ockham, Petrarch. Petrarch was fascinated with the culture of Greece and Rome, and he had a desire to revive what we might call pagan learning because of a great nostalgia for the past that he saw there. Petrarch enjoyed the natural world. He had a new attitude, if you will, or displayed the new Renaissance attitude and interest in the particulars of the realm of nature. And so you'll read just about everywhere the significance of his ascending a particular mountain and just being taken by the beauty of the vista that he saw from the top of the mountain and writing about that. That's nothing new. I mean, we all do that when we go on vacation, right? But in that day and age, that was not considered all that important. Petrarch said, just savor the beauty of this natural vista. Now, he did allegorize it and turn it into something pious and spiritual as well, but it also was enjoyed for itself. Because Petrarch was interested in the classics, he came to have respect. And those like him came to have respect for people who relied on a rational approach to thinking and understanding the world.